Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the third and final part of our series, Defining Era of Jewish History, Part 2. This is number 3 of Part 2, which is the birth of the Talmud. So we've spent the past couple of weeks understanding, to a certain extent, the life and times of Chazal, getting a little bit of an understanding about the people who we actually encounter within the Talmud, learning a little bit about their lives, the world in which they lived, the ways they went about and did their things, both religiously. You know, we talked last week a little bit about what Torah learning would have looked like in the times of Chazal. The week before, we talked about really everything else that Chazal would have encountered. And what we also started talking about last week was the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. And if I were to summarize the most important points from what we talked about, both in the previous series when we talked about the birth of the Mishnah, together with what we spoke about last week, which was the Yerushalmi, that fundamentally the most important figure or figures in the crafting of all of these rabbinic documents that we have come across so far, all of these texts, are the editors or the redactors. So we have the Mishnah, we have the Tosefta, who essentially, if we just think of first of all, the editor of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, is kind of the clearest example of this. What did he do? He took all of the various statements of the Tanaim being a term to describe the rabbis who lived roughly 0 through 200 CE, and he took their various statements and he arranged those statements in various sections pertaining to various themes. He chose which statements to drop. Obviously, there are statements that never made it into the Mishnah. They were edited out. That's what an editor does. He chose what statements to drop. He chose what statements to include. He chose what statements to put in contrast to one another. And that's really the role of an editor. And we saw that again with the Tosefta, which is a parallel, if more expansive, document to the Mishnah from that same era. And then we also saw last week, that's essentially what's going on with the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi is mainly providing us with an additional commentary on the Mishnah, first and foremost, by introducing us to any Tosefta that complicates our understanding of the Mishnah, as well as the statements of the Amoraim. Amoraim being the term we give to the rabbis who lived from, again, roughly 200 through 400 CE, Amoraim, if Tanaim means the teachers, Amoraim means the statement makers, the sayers. So the Amoraim, Amar Rav Yosef, etc., 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 Amar Rava, etc., etc., etc. They said stuff. They said comments, usually those comments added to, complicated, refined what the Mishnah was saying, translating the Mishnah into slightly more practice for their day. But fundamentally, that's what the Amoraim did. And when we encounter the Yerushalmi, what the editors of the Yerushalmi, whoever they were, did was essentially arrange things in such a way to preserve the sense that the Tosefta and the Amoraim are commentating on and complicating the Mishnah. That's basically it. And so you might remember last week, you know, I'd color-coded a small part of the Yerushalmi, and red was what I used to color-code the statements of the Amoraim. And as we saw, basically the whole thing was red. For in the chunk we analyzed, it was basically completely the statements of the Amoraim. And this kind of makes sense, bearing in mind two facts, one of which I've mentioned already, and one I mentioned last week and will repeat now, which is the Yerushalmi is closed in roughly 400 CE. Obviously not that clean a date, but as with everything, we're not using clean dates, we're using rough dates. The Yerushalmi is closed in 400 CE. And as I mentioned, the Amoraim, the era of the Amoraim is over in 400 CE. And so it makes sense that the Yerushalmi is only going to contain the statements of Tanaim, the rabbis who lived 0 through 200 CE, and Amoraim, the rabbis who lived up until 400 CE. But everything I've just said about an editor, everything I've just said about the role that an editor plays, goes out of the window when we turn to the Bavli, when we turn to the Gemara, what we actually consider to be the most influential and defining form of oral law, the Babylonian Talmud, the Gemara, there the editors play a far more dramatic and significant role. They don't simply place things where they belong. They don't simply choose to place certain rabbis in conversations with each other. We saw that last week. We saw a quote-unquote debate between rabbis. But as I pointed out last week, those rabbis did not live at the same time period as each other. They didn't know each other. The Yerushalmi, the editors of the Yerushalmi, put those three rabbis in debate with one another in order to make their point. Now, that's classic, that's standard, nothing strange there, nothing unusual there. But the Bavli takes everything the editors do for all the other works, and then it twists the dial all the way to 10, and then it breaks the dial off and just keeps it stuck in this position far beyond anything anyone else can comprehend. The era of the Bavli. So the Yerushalmi spans 200 through 400 CE, roughly. The Bavli spans 200 through 600 CE. Now again, the era of the Amoraim is over. It's done in the 400s. And yet the Bavli goes through another 200 years, or its lifespan again, before it is closed. What on earth is going on during those 200 years that Yerushalmi never got? And the answer is everything. So what's really cool about this is, I'm going to point out when we do get to the kind of the pages, I'll point out, in fact, before that, because I have some sources kind of on the generic source sheet first, but I'll point out very soon the telltale sign of when you can spot the editors in the Bavli. And once you see it, you can never not see it again, because it's so blatantly obvious. It's not like it's hidden, but it's just you don't notice it until your attention is drawn to it. But to a certain extent, we would never know about these rabbis who edited the Gemara, or it would maybe be scholarly conjecture, it would be theory, were it not for Rav Shrira Gaon. So Rav Shrira Gaon lived after the close of the Talmud. He lived in the 900s. The next installment of defining era of Jewish history, which please God will be next year, will be on the period of the Gaonim, the rabbis who lived after the close of the Talmud, kind of at the dawn of the medieval era, the first rabbis to view the Talmud as a closed book. Gaon, as I mention every single time I bring them up, is an acronym for their title, Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. They were the heads of the academies, the Rosh Yeshiva. Gaon Yaakov means the pride of the Jewish people. So the most famous, Rav Sadia Gaon, the grandfather of Jewish philosophy, literature, Hebrew, the Siddur, all of these things. Rav Shura Gaon also, I mean, they were all very, very influential rabbis. And in the 900s, he was asked by the Jewish community of Kairunan, not sure if that's how you pronounce it, he was asked, how did Torah Sheba Alpeh go from whatever, Har Sinai, to the 900s, where we have Rav Shura Gaon, we have the Gaonim, who are teaching, in some sense, the Talmud, the Gemara. How did we go from A to B? And his essay is interesting. It is what we might call nowadays a very from retelling of the history of Torah Sheba Alpeh. But nonetheless, just because you know, if an academic wouldn't be so satisfied by just how pious Rav Shura Gaon is in explaining things, nonetheless, he mentions certain facts that otherwise we would not know existed. Most crucially, he mentions a group of rabbis who otherwise we would not know existed. We have the Tanoim, the teachers. We have the Amoraim, the sayers. And again, Tanoim 0 through 200, Amoraim 200 through 400. We have the Gaonim, who begin after the close of the Talmud. And the question always, you know, without Rav Shurgon's letter, we'd always ask, we know that Amorim generation ends long before the Gaonic period begins. What happens in between? Rav Shura Gaon introduces us to a term, the Savoraim. Savoraim literally means the logickers, which, as we are going to see, is a very sensible title for them. The Savoraim, says Rav Shura Gaon, edited the Gemara. They fashioned the Gemara during a 200-year period. They turned the statements of the Amoraim commentating on the Mishnah into the Bavli as we have it. That, and then at some point, they decided it's now a closed book. We are, you know, that is sometimes, I've said this before, the best description of when the period of the Gaonim begins is it's the first rabbis to stop writing inside the text of the Talmud and the first rabbis to start writing commentaries on the text, rather than interleaving their commentaries within, which already gives you a clue as to whether what the Savoraim are going to be doing. But the Savoraim shaped the Bavli into what we know to this day. We don't know a single name of a Savora. We don't know any of their names because that's their call sign. Their call sign is not naming themselves. Now, the hard and fast rule, which isn't completely good, but broadly speaking, I'll already say it now. How do you know when you're reading the Savoraim versus the regular Amoraim? You open up an Art Scroll Gemara. And as you start reading your Art Scroll Gemara, More often than not, Koren do the same thing. The Steinsaltz, which is available for free all on Sfaria, it will say, the Gemara asks. It refers to the Gemara as kind of an abstract entity in and of itself. Now, obviously, the Gemara is not itself a sentient being. When it says the Gemara, as opposed to Rav Yosef asks, you know, sometimes I'll let you know, Rav Yosef asks Rav Nachman the following question. As opposed to the Gemara asks the following question about Rav Yosef's statement, who is the Gemara? The Gemara is the Savoraim, its editors. Every single feature of the Bavli, every single aspect to the Gemara that makes it quintessentially Gemara, the crazy back and forth, the permutations upon permutations upon permutations, the hypotheticals upon hypotheticals upon hypotheticals, all of those things were the work of the Savoraim. The Amoraim themselves, broadly speaking, made statements and commented on each other's statements in subsequent generations. But it was the Savoraim who really, really passed every single statement of an Amora, every single statement of a Mishnah under their microscope of analysis and subjected it to so many questions. One of the things that the Savoraim do is literally every single statement found by the Mishnah, by an Amora, is analyzed. If it conflicts with another, they attempt to synthesize. They try to explain how, and we'll see an example of this evening, they try to explain how both versions are necessary, or alternatively, they'll try to claim that both versions are actually hinting at the same thing. Two really good examples of this that I'm going to share the source sheet at this point, and I'll put and we'll read them together. Two really good examples of this are the openings to Masechet Shabbat and Masechet Sukkah. Now, the truth is, this is a pretty standard opening. This is something that I'll mention the story now, because when I say I'll mention the story later, I'll forget to mention the story later, and then it's not that exciting a story, and I'm billing it up, and then I forget, and people wonder. Last year on Tikkun Leil Shavuot, as I already mentioned, the Tikkun Leil schedule will please God go out tomorrow, but last year on Tikkun Leil Shavuot, there were a group of guys enthused by the spirit of the moment who wanted to start learning Gemara together. Naturally, they chose the very beginning of Masechet Brachot, which is the very, very first thing in the Gemara. Turns out the opening to Brachot is pretty tricky, and I'll talk more about that soon. But the opening to most Masechtot is pretty tricky and usually one of the least exciting parts of any learning venture. If we take a look first at the beginning of Masechet Shabbat. So the Mishnah teaches us the following. The very, very first Mishnah of Masechet Shabbat says, it's talking about the prohibition of carrying on Shabbat. Yitziat HaShabbat. When it comes to the prohibition of carrying on Shabbat, Shtayim Shehin Arba Bifnim, Ushtayim Shehin Arba Bachutz. There are two basic actions that actually capture four different possible issues from the perspective of the person inside a private domain and two other paradigms that result in four different issues for someone standing outside, someone in the public domain. The meaning of this isn't important. I will just draw your attention once again to the fact that I've made, both in the previous time when we talked about the Mishnah, but also I think I've mentioned it more recently, the Mishnah always tries to go for something that conceptually makes sense and is memorable. So Shtayim Shehim Arba Bifnim, Shtayim Shehim Arba Bachutz, two that are four inside, two that are four outside, sounds really confusing, and the Mishnah goes on to explain what it means. I just took that out because it's not relevant for our purposes, but that's the kind of thing that will stick in your mind, that you will remember because it's conceptually reduced everything to case examples. But here the Gemara asks the following, the very first statement of the Gemara. In other words, the Savorim ask the following. Tanan Hatam. So they quote the very first Mishnah of Masechet Shavuot. Masechet Shavuot has absolutely nothing to do with the festival of Shavuot. Shavuot means weeks. Shavuot means oaths. Sounds pretty similar, but very, very different. Tanan Hatam, they quote the Mishnah in Shavuot, which says, Shvuot Shtayim Shehin Arba, that when it comes to oaths, there are two paradigms that comprise four cases, Yidiot HaTum'ah, knowledge of ritual impurity, two that are four, Mar'ot Nega'im, appearances, signs of Tzara'at, which is usually translated as leprosy, but it isn't, Shnayim Shehin Arba, Yitziot HaShabbat Shtayim Shehin Arba. That's the first mission in Shavuot, to which the Gemara asks, "My Shana Hachi, the Tane, Shtayim Shein Arba Bifnim Ushtayim Shein Arba Bachutz." Why does the opening Mishnah of Masechet Shabbat say two that are four inside and two that are four outside? "Umay Shana Hatam, the Tane Shtayim Shein Arba." The Torah was, why does the Mishnah in Shavuot only say two that are four? In other words, this is a really, really, really pedantic issue. This is legal pedanticism at its finest. Mishnah in Shabbat says two that are four inside, two that are four outside. Mishnah in Shavuot, speaking about the exact same thing, says just two that are four. This bothers the Gemara. In other words, it bothers the Savorim. They are bothered by this because we have two Mishnayot in tension, two Mishnayot that conflict. And then the Gemara devotes an inordinate amount of time trying to build a theory in order to explain why we have this discrepancy, not important for our purposes. Similarly, how does Masechet Sukkot begin? So we learn the very first Mishnah of Masechet Sukkah, not Masechet Sukkot, Masechet Sukkah. The very first Mishnah of Sukkah says, Sukkah shehi gavoa lamala me'esrim ama, a Sukkah, the schach, that's 20 cubits high, psola. It's possible, it's unfit, it doesn't count as a sukkah. For Rabbi Yehuda Machshir, Rabbi Yehuda, however, says it's fine. What does the Gemara ask? Tanan Hatam, it quotes the beginning of Eruvin, the very first Mishnah in Eruvin. Mavoi, Shehu Gavoa Me'esrim Ama, when you have a plank over an alleyway making essentially an Eruv that's 20 amot high, Yema'it, you have to lower it. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Einotar, Rabbi Yehuda says it's fine. So note the similarity between these two Mishnayot. We have 20 Amot being a watershed moment. We have Rabbi Yehuda not being bothered by it. But nonetheless, there's a fundamental difference between the two. Says the Gemara, in other words, ask the Savorim, My shana gabe sukkah detane psula, umay shani gaba mavoi detane takanta. Why in one area of halacha do we say it's posel, it's unfit, it doesn't count, burn the sukkah down, you've done it wrong. Don't actually burn it down. Whereas why do we, when it comes to an eruv, we're like, hey, you can fix that. Again, this is, it's a different form of legal pedantism. The first example, Masechet Shabbat, is about the framing, the very words chosen. In Sukkah, the Gemara is picking up, the Savarim are picking up on two similar, logically similar paradigms. 20 Amot being an issue, and yet in one there is a fix, in one there isn't a fix, and then again it devotes an inordinate amount of time attempting to figure out a resolution between the two. This is one classic example of what the Savoraim do. They pass every single statement of the Mishnah, every single statement of the Amoraim under a microscope, trying to understand why there are conflicting ideas, why things that don't make sense, why they don't make sense, and trying to make sense of them. That's one major aspect that the Gemara does. Something else it does a lot also is what we might call the technical dirty work. So when I was a mathematics student back in the day at the University of Manchester, I remember being taught, though not really understanding, which was one of the reasons I was a math student at the University of Manchester, and then I'm a graduate of philosophy from Yeshiva University. But we were taught why, you know, one of the most basic, fundamental, obvious tenets of mathematics, x times zero is zero. Anything multiplied by zero always results in zero. That's a fundamental principle of mathematics, crucial one. How does that work? Why is that the case? It turns out that there is a pretty long, lengthy, circuitous, mind-bending mathematical proof one can use to illustrate the fact that anything times zero equals zero. Someone's got to do that. Mathematicians do that in our society. Pure mathematicians, that's their job, to prove the truth of certain things using logic. You always need someone to do that. The Savoraim do a lot of the same thing with halacha. Someone has to try and prove why a given statement of the oral law is true. And so you'll often encounter, and it's often when learning Gemara a deeply frustrating experience, because it takes a long time to get through. And in the back of your mind, you're always wondering, why am I being put through this? But the Gemara will often attempt to find verses, or will often, biblical verses, or will often attempt to find some other way of proving something to be true. The Savoraim do the dirty work. What Jews took for granted for years, the Savoraim just, they do it. There is definitely a certain amount of also reconstruction. I've spoken about this before, how by the time we're in the year 400 through 600 CE, much of Judaism has been rebuilt. But we also have to remember that a large part of the, remember I had mentioned this, the Mishnah essentially assumes the Beit HaMikdash is still standing. I mean, it knows it's not, but it kind of acts as though it is. By the time we're at circa 400 CE, that's a long time since the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. That's 400 plus years, almost. But between 400 and 600, you get the idea. It's a long time. Several hundred years have passed. For the Savoraim living during that time, there is a lot less they can take for granted as knowing automatically. The Tanoim were close enough to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash to have known how certain things functioned. The Amoraim, okay, we're now a few generations later, but still had enough of a connection. Whereas the Savoraim, that is so far beyond any memory, any institutional memory, any generational memory, that they also put a lot of effort into trying to understand how things work, trying to reconstruct how things would have worked because they don't know it for themselves. The final thing to draw your attention to is that there is a certain level of literary flair to the Savarim. So going back to the first daf of Masachet Brachot, which I didn't put on the source sheet, but it asks a lot of very strange questions about the Shema. The opening Mishnah of Masachet Brachot, the opening Mishnah to Mishnah, talks about our obligation to say Shema, and the Gemara starts asking a bunch of strange questions, attempting to prove that the Shema is the case. But as everyone on that uncle points out, these questions aren't the best kinds of questions, don't even make the most amount of sense. And there's a really fascinating suggestion that's been proposed by some scholars in the recent past, which is that the opening pages to Masachet Brachot are almost a tutorial into how the Bavli, how the Gemara is going to function as a whole. If you want to understand how the Savarim function, get yourself either, you know, go on Sfaria and read the opening pages, the opening page of Masachet Brachot, you know, read the Steinsaltz translation, read an art scroll, and you'll spot a bunch of really, really strange questions that don't seem to be the most necessary questions to ask, but therein lies the point. They are asking these questions in order to teach you this is how their minds function. What the Savarim do is obsess over everything. The best analogy, and it's not a pejorative one, though I'm not sure how well this analogy will hit to each and every one of you individually, is what's modern day nerd culture. Modern day nerd culture are a group of people obsessed around a certain topic. So this Friday, you know, is the brand new Star Wars Obi-Wan Kenobi show. What's going to happen after that's released? Parts of the internet will be aflame with discussions about how this episode of Obi-Wan Kenobi impacts our general understanding of the Star Wars universe. Does it help resolve conflicts? What are these various narrative plot points we previously assumed to be settled that are now being reopened? People will obsess over it. The Savarim were doing that hundreds of years before anyone else thought to do so. Why does Rav Yosef say this? Why does Rav Nachman say this? What does Rav Yosef's statement teach us about everything ever said by Rav Nachman? Those sorts of ideas, it's that obsession with every single line of the Amoraim, of the Tanoim, that gives the Savarim, that gives the Bavli its unique flavor. To get a clearer example of this, I want to do like what I did last week and again show you Photoshop pages of Gemara. So first we have, and again, I'm going to zoom out a little bit. This is a standard, if you open to Lamed Vav Amud Bet 36b of Masachet Brachot of a standard Vilna Shas, this is what you'd see in the Gemara in the middle, commentators on the left and right. I think last week I said I would give a brief explanation of what the typical daf of Gemara looks like, so I'll take just the briefest amount of time to just mention that the middle section is the actual Gemara. On the depending on the side of the spine the page is on, but we have Rashi on one side, in this case it's on the left, we have the commentary of Tosafot on the right, and then we have a whole bunch of other useful things on these further left right columns. There are lots of, you know, little footnote markers all around here, drawing attention to all these various things. That is your standard page of the Gemara. Fine, nothing too exciting right now. The first thing that I did, like last time, was I just took everything out that's not relevant, and we have zooming issues at this point, I'm not sure why, but now we zoom out to a reasonable size, and basically the discussion relevant to our purposes in the Gemara in Masachet Brachot comprises of this amount. Right, not. Don't worry, we're not learning through the whole thing, because that's a lot of text to get through. But you can see a pretty decent. Now, you might already remember last week, I showed you the parallel Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi read the whole thing off. It was like a handful of lines. This is its equivalent, essentially, in the Bavli. So you already get a sense of just the size difference. What I did next was I took out everything but the statements of the Amoraim. The statements of the Amoraim, roughly speaking, and this is not an exact science, Or maybe to put it a different way, I am not skilled enough to do it as an exact science, but I'm true, roughly correct in what I'm showing you. This is the statement. So this is the entire text. This is the statement of the Amalrad. That may not even be correct, but there you go. Everything in green is the Savorim. So when I mention that the Savorim give the Bavli its unique flavor and shape it into what they are, this is what I mean. Literally, you know, and this is not a particularly unusual pages of Bavli to be encountering. This is how it works. Now, to illustrate just a little bit of how the Savorim work in practice, we're just going to focus on this bit here. So first of all, in the red, we have the comments of the Amorim. So I didn't put the Mishnah on the source sheet again, but to remind you, we have the Mishnah in the very first Mishnah of chapter 6 of Masechet Brachot, which gives basically a list of the categories that certain Brachot belong to. And then the Gemara, then we get the following statement of the Amorim. Now, again, obviously, this has been already placed, edited in a certain form. But the point is, these are, if the Bavli worked more like the Yerushalmi, this is what it would look like. Chavitz Kedera, V'chein Daisa, with regards to a thing called Chavitz, boiled in a pot, and also Daisa, which is pounded grain. Rav Yehuda Amar Shakol Nihyeh Bidvaro. Rav Yehuda says the bracha is Shakol. Rav Kahana Amar Borei Mine Mezonot. Fine. Just like we saw with the Yerushalmi, just like kind of fits with the Mishnah, we have examples of foods not necessarily clearly covered by the Mishnah's categories. And so we have Rav Yehuda and Rav Kahana debating the bracha. Then along comes Rav Yosef in the next red section. Amar Rav Yosef, Kavda de Rav Kahana, Mistavra. The opinion of Rav Kahana makes more sense. The Rav Ushmuel de Amri Travaihu, because he quotes the statement of Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel are the first generation Amoraim, the most respected of the Amoraim. They both said, Kol sheyeshbo mechameshet haminin. Mavarachin alav borei mine mezonot. Anything that comes from the five species of grain gets a mezonot. Fine. If this were the Yerushalmi, we'd be like, that was good, let's close it and all go home. It makes sense. The Amoraim make perfect sense here. They introduce, we come across a debate regarding a food item not clearly captured by the Mishnah. We're introduced to Shakol and borei mine mezonot. And we get a resolution to the debate by another Amora. Rav Yosef comes along to tell us what the resolution is. Yet, as you can tell by the vast gaps, the Savorim weigh in here. What happens? The following. So again, Chavitz Kedera, right at the beginning of the red, regarding these two types of food, Chavitz Kedera v'chein Daisa. Rav Yehuda Amar Shakol Nia Bedvarov, Rav Kahana Amar Borim Nia Mezonot. We had a debate between these two, a disagreement that Rav Yosef, if we only read the Amoraim, resolves pretty elegantly. Not for the Savorim. The Savorim don't like major debates. They don't like the Amoraim to have fundamental disagreements about what's correct. As often as possible, the Savorim will try to blur the lines of debate between different Amorim. They will try to make them as in agreement as possible. And thus we read in the green. Bedaisa greda. They modify it. When it comes to a simple pounded grain. Don't ask me what that looks like, but simple pounded grain. Kule alma lo pligi de boremine mezonot. Everyone actually agrees it's Boraimi name is Zonot. When we read that debate just before between Rav Yehuda and Rav Kahana, they were never actually debating Daisa Greda. The Amoraim said Daisa, no. Daisa Greda, no one disagreed. Ki Pligi, Bedaisa, Ke'in, Chovitz, Kedera. They disagree when the pounded grain is made in the same fashion as this other item, Chovitz Kedera. Translating and understanding these terms is less important because of the point that I'm just trying to convey, which is the craziness of trying to resolve this debate. Rav Yehuda Amar Shahakol Nia. Did Rav Yehuda Amar Shahakol? Rav Yehuda says it's Shahakol Savar Duvsha Ika, because he believes the honey is the main ingredient. Rav Kahana Amar Boraimi Nei Mezonot Sadar Smeda Iker. Rav Kahana, the reason he says it's Boraimi Nei Mezonot, because the main ingredient is the flour. Let's unpack this for a second. They've not only changed the food we are debating, but they've provided us with the logic behind the rabbi, the Amoraim's viewpoints. Savoram, you'll remember I said this earlier, literally translates as the logicers, because they like providing the logic behind why rabbis said what they did. Honestly, we don't know necessarily why Rav Yehuda thought X, why Rav Kahana thought Y. The Savoraim, in many cases, they do know. It's been handed down to them, and they thought it was important to preserve for posterity. But also, the Savoraim might think it's important to explain this debate. And so what they do is they start to provide logic rooted in a core principle of brachot, which is the core ingredient dictates the bracha that you make. So what we see then is this next statement of the red. And this is crucial. Rav Yosef is no longer commenting on the other statement in the red. Rav Yosef is no longer, if you read the Bavli just as is, Rav Yosef is no longer seen as commenting on the original statement, but on the modified statement. And so what Rav Yosef is ultimately agreeing to from the perspective of the reader of Gemara is Rav Kahana's belief that you follow the flour when flour is in an ingredient. That is, in a nutshell, what the Savoraim do. They interject in the middle of the statement of the Amoraim, modify the statement of the Amoraim, change the case, change the scenario, change the situation, explain the logic behind it, and then turn the other statements of the Amoraim into further validation of what the Savoraim inserted. The one final thing I want to draw your attention to with this is what happens next. First of all, we get a keyword, gufa. Gufa always indicates a text was just quoted. Statements were just quoted. And because they were just quoted, now it's their turn to go under the Savoraic microscope. What was quoted by Rav Yosef? The statement of Rav and Shmuel. Now that Rav and Shmuel's statement has just been brought up, the Savoraim have to start analyzing it. Gufa. They drag that statement back up. Rav Ushmuel da Amri Travayhu, kol she yeshbo mechameshet haminim mevarachin alav borei minei mezanot. Whatever is made of the five species is mezonot. The itmar nami, but hold on a second, it's stated elsewhere. Rav Ushmuel da Amri Travayhu, kol shehu. Anything that is made from the five grains. And then what most of the rest of this is discussing is that we have one statement of Rav and Shmuel called Sheyeshbo, and we have another statement of Rav and Shmuel saying called Shehu, concluding the same thing, and yet those are different words. Lawyers, I imagine, would be, this is what lawyers do as a day job. Lawyers use, you know, lawyers peer through statements, words, double checking whether the intent of the word means what it does. I imagine that is something a lawyer would, I'm not a lawyer, by the way, you may have noticed based on that wonderful description of the lawyer's daily job. But that is essentially what the Savorim are doing. They are looking at discrepancies and seeking to resolve them, not to point out flaws, but to help elucidate and explain core ideas of Jewish law. But in doing so, the typical daf of Gemara, if we colored it in, looks a little like this. Now, the truth is within here, within all this green, they are bringing lots of things. For example, I know I said previously the last thing I want to draw your attention to, but I remember there's one other thing I want to draw your attention to. Right over here in the green, where you can see my mouse hovering, Hakoseis et hachita mavarich alaha borei pri ha'adama. Now that sounds awfully like the Tosefta. Lower down here where my mouse is hovering, Hakoseis et ha'oreis, one who chews oreis. We'll remember from when we talked about the Tosefta, from the Yerushalmi last week, we encountered these also. The crucial difference is the Yerushalmi is far more Tosefta-centric. Here, the Tosefta is being brought up by the Savorim as a way of backing up a point, as a way of just kind of lending further credence to certain viewpoints. The Savorim give the Bavli everything about its character. And when you learn through a daf of Gemara, what you can start to recognize pretty quickly, and I personally find this very, it makes it a lot easier. It makes it a lot simpler to learn Gemara. It doesn't change the intellectual challenge sometimes of trying to wrap your head around something, but it does make it far simpler to be able to follow the flow of what's going on. Because when you realize, oh, this is now, because one of the hardest things nowadays you can kind of copy and paste a text of Gemara into Microsoft Word, and you can take tremendous advantage of the bullet point feature to keep on nesting things more and more and more and more, so you can actually follow the thread of the actual Gemara and not get too sidetracked by what the Gemara's getting sidetracked by. But what it helps you understand, it can help you process the various sidetracking constantly taking place. But the Savorim spent 200 years, the exact same amount of time, roughly speaking, that the Amorim themselves lived, putting every single statement by the Tanoim, by the Amorim, under the microscope through the lens of mental conceptual inquiry, attempting to understand and attempting to explain. And in doing so, they crafted the most fascinating, you know, Jewish work ever made, and one that has so much depth and so much complexity, and really interestingly is still actually easier to understand than the Yerushalmi, because the Bavli takes a lot less for granted. So it kind of does, it, no one would ever say the Bavli holds your hand at any point when attempting to learn it, but if one compares the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, there is at least maybe the faint outline of a hand, you know, asking to be held by the Bavli as opposed to the Yerushalmi. But the Bavli, really, the Savorim are what make it what it is. These rabbis who we know nothing about, we don't even know their names, basically, who lived for 200 years debating, refining the statements of the Amorim, turning it into the Bavli as we know it, and thus creating the most significant and important, you know, Jewish book, you know, we have had, the one that defines everything else that we do, by these rabbis we don't know the names of, who lived for 200 years, but fundamentally crafted everything the way we know it.